Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In 2004, historian Russell Shorto published The Island at the Center of the World, about Manhattan and the role of the Dutch in making New York and America what it is today. His new book, Taking Manhattan, The Extraordinary Events That Created New York and Shaped America, continues that story of New York. It's 1664, and England has decided to invade the Dutch colony of New Netherland. Charles II and his brother, the Duke of York, have dreams of empire, and the Dutch, their arch rivals, are in the way. But Richard Nichols, the military officer who leads the English flotilla bent on destruction, changes his strategy once he encounters Peter Stuyvesant, New Netherland's director general. At the brink of bloodshed, the two leaders recognized they had common ground. The book reveals the founding of New York to be an invention, the result of negotiations that would blend the multi-ethnic capitalistic society of New Amsterdam with the power of the rising English Empire. Russell Shorto is the best-selling author of 8 books, including Small Time, Revolution Song, Amsterdam, and the aforementioned Island at the Center of the World. He is the director of the New Amsterdam Project at New York Historical, and we welcome Russell Shorto to this week's book. I have to say that I love this book so much, and here's what I loved about it. This was, to me, this was like just a great page turner. It's a fantastic story that just you unleash and you let go. And this is hardly, I mean, I didn't read it as history. I just read it as just a damn good story. It's just incredible how you bring all those threads together and make it so riveting.
Joe, you are my kind of interviewer. Meaning, what I mean is, I mean, often people will say, oh, I really liked your book. I learned so much. And that's nice, but I feel a little bit irritated because I think of myself as a storyteller more than like an information purveyor. So what I want people to say is I was completely engrossed more than I learned a lot. Ideally, obviously, both.
Yes, ideally, and certainly the case with me. But correct me if I'm wrong. You just seem so excited to tell us the story.
Well, there's a long period of time in which one is sifting through ideas, and one has to grab you. One has to really move me for me to decide. Okay, I'm going to devote years of my life to it. So yeah, I have to be really enthusiastic about it. And for me, a story, a book subject is a story. And a story means conflict. It means two or more people in conflict. And in this case, you've got, you know, it's 2 weeks in the late summer of 1664. You've got the English in their ships in the harbor pointing their cannons at the tip of Manhattan Island. And you've got the Dutch in their fort pointing their cannons back. And that's conflict.
And you say you think of them almost as siblings.
You mean England and the Netherlands. Yeah, at the time, throughout the 17th century, the English and the Dutch were bitter rivals. They were a lot alike, but the Dutch were ahead. They were one or two steps ahead in this, you know, the 17th century is this era of European powers being newly strengthened and looking around the world and like, oh, I can take that piece of West Africa, and I can take that island in Asia, and you know that's this whole era of colonialism and slavery and all of this that we are still living with the effects of, and the Dutch were preeminent. This little tiny nation in Western Europe, much smaller than any other, was probably the most powerful nation in the world for a time, and other European countries couldn't figure it out, and they couldn't get over it. And in the English language, they're now kind of old-fashioned, but all those sayings, derogatory sayings that have Dutch in them, like Dutch treat and Dutch uncle and going Dutch, they all come from the 17th century, from pamphlets that the English wrote when they were just annoyed at these, how can they do it?
And that's what lasts. That's interesting.
That's what lasts. Well, yeah. Also what lasts in the English language are things like words like cookies and coleslaw and Santa Claus. All those are Dutch that come out of the Dutch colony into English.
What was it about after the island at the center of the world? Did you know eventually you would take on the other part of the story?
No, I didn't. That was the island at the center of the world told the story of this Dutch colony, which lasted 40 years. And the reason I came to write it was I got to know Charles Gehring, who you know as well, who has since 1974 been translating and publishing the 12,000 pages of the official records of this Dutch colony. I had spent a little time with Charlie, and I got to realize, well, it changed my whole orientation. You can tell the story of American beginnings from this colony that became New York just as easily as from the Puritan or Pilgrim colonies of New England. So I immersed myself, and Charlie and Jani Venema, who worked with him for a long time, they gave me a desk in their office in the State Library in Albany, and I worked alongside them and wrote the book. So this 12,000 pages has been, I mean, Charlie's still at it. He's retiring this month, actually. And it's, I'd say, the past 5 or 6 or 7 years, that translation effort, they completed the last years of the colony. I mean, they're not going strictly chronological, but they got that completed. And as I sat back and looked at that, and this is just raw stuff, you know, it's court cases and council minutes and he stole my pig and he stole my wife and just all this kind of, you know, it's interesting, but you know, what do you do with it? So when I saw it in its latter stages, this little community of New Amsterdam, where it was really booming, and you had it kind of looked like a Wild West town, but with Dutch, you know, it had gables and windmills and things. These traders there, everybody was a trader, and they had networks that going to the Caribbean and to South America and different parts of Europe. So when in seeing these records at its height, that's what made me think, the story, now I can see it as Richard Nichols, who I guess we're going to get to in a minute, the Englishman who comes sailing into the harbor, as he would have seen it, as this fruit that has now ripened.
You say this early in the book, Richard Nichols, who you write about, and as such a central part of the story, not well known to history. There is an Encyclopedia of New York, and his name is not in it.
And he was the first governor of New York. He invented New York, is basically what I claim in the book. He set up many of the parameters of New York, and the Encyclopedia of New York City doesn't have an entry on it.
How does that happen?
I don't know. I should ask Ken Jackson. He was the editor.
Yes, he was. But I'm fascinated that a story like that, because we usually know about the winners and less about the losers.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a funny thing. Stuyvesant, anybody who grew up in New York City, Stuyvesant Town, Stuyvesant High School, but there's no Richard Nichols Way or anything. If there is, I don't know it.
But even in Albany, I mean, the Stuyvesant name is all mm-hmm. over, and, yeah, and it's yeah. very prominent
sure.
Throughout New York.
Throughout the whole region, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Stuyvesant was here for a long time. He was in power as the last director of the colony for 17 years. And between my work on the island at the center of the world and this book, I have come to have a much more nuanced appreciation for him and what he did for his part to invent what became New York. So then after this, the invention happens, and he has to go back to Europe because in inventing New York, he gave up his charge. He gave up this Dutch colony. So he had to defend himself. And after this lengthy process, he's finally exonerated, and he comes back. So he lives out his days, actually as kind of an advisor to Nichols. So he was here for a very long time to imprint himself on the landscape, I guess. Whereas Nichols, for all he did, it was a job. He was here for 4 years, and by the end of it, he was like, okay, I'm ready to go home.
You make that point a few times in the book, and it was really interesting to me in the sense that it's a job. It's almost as if, you know, you sign up for the Marine Corps for 4 years, you do your time, and then you're out.
Yeah, I think he might have stayed. I mean, he's an interesting guy, and it's so interesting to research someone. It's exciting to research someone who is so consequential and so unknown, because you get a chance to sort of, you know, discover him or bring him back to life. I think he might have stayed, but what drove him crazy was New Jersey. And this may speak for other people too, New Netherland was this large chunk of the Eastern Seaboard, encompassing all our parts of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, parts of Pennsylvania and Delaware. So that was the Dutch colony. So, and we're probably going to talk in a moment about how it happened that it became, that he took it and it became an English colony called New York. And it was that originally then that whole swath. But shortly after he took it and he had plans for developing it, and he's, okay, here's Manhattan Island and we're calling this New York City, and this is going to be our base, and we've got the Hudson River and all this land on the west side of the river, this big harbor, how we're going to do this. And then he gets word from Europe that his patron, the Duke of York, for whom he, Nichols, named the place, says that he had a friend who had supported him in the English Civil War, who had been the governor of the island of Jersey, and he's giving him the whole west side of the Hudson River. And Nichols is like, well, wait a second, I had all these plans for that. That can't be a different jurisdiction. So Nichols starts writing him, and he was very courtly in his letters, but in these letters he gets more and more frantic. And at one point he says, look, why don't you give him Delaware? That's, no, it stayed, and it became New Jersey. And Nichols was going to call that, because James was the Duke of York, he was also the Duke of Albany. And so Nichols named the second city Albany. And he was going to name this swath of territory Albania. And my little joke here is that there are many New Yorkers who still think of New Jersey as Albania. But that always works, except in New Jersey. As time went on, that really just irritated him. And I think that's when he said, you know, I think I'm done.
When you say the title of the book, Taking Manhattan, it's really twice, right? It's taken twice.
Yeah, well, obviously the first time the Dutch took it from the native people. And I spend a good amount of time in the book dwelling on that, because it's obviously important. In 1626, the Dutch were very meticulous about business matters, and they wanted to get everything in writing. And they negotiated hundreds of deeds with the native people up and down here, or throughout New Netherland, for territory. And they knew, certainly in the beginning, Manhattan Island was the first of these, and the Dutch were perfectly aware that the native people did not have a concept of real estate and property transfer and that sort of thing. But it was important for them, because they wanted to be able to show other Europeans, especially the English, look, we got the paper here. But for the native people, it would have been something more like an alliance that allowed the Europeans to come and live, and they would continue to use the island. And if one of them was attacked, the other one would help out. And it was of value to the native people too. They were not helpless, just lying there and being stepped upon. They valued European manufactured goods. So they thought that they were getting something out of it. Now, what quickly happens in really just a very few years is the Europeans, and this goes for the Dutch in New Netherland and the English in New England, become stronger than them, in large part because of disease that the Europeans brought, which really wiped out populations. And then they just start pushing them out, because then they start to say, oh no, we have a deed, so you have to go. So that begins then this whole process that continues to California all the way across the continent.
And when we talk about the indigenous people, it is a great mixture, but we are speaking of the Lenape.
The people in the area around New York City, New Jersey, south to Delaware, were and are variously known as Lenape, Muncie, and Delaware, and they are still very much present in and around New York and New Jersey, in Ontario and Wisconsin, in other places.
And there were other settlements.
Yeah, up further north here on the east side of the Hudson, it's the Mahican, and then on the west side, the Haudenosaunee or Iroquois people. The easternmost of those is the Mohawk, and then moving westward all the way to the Seneca, were the keepers of the Western Gate. And the Dutch had to know, and these are different people speaking different languages from one another, and different cultures, and so the Dutch had to know how to deal with all of them.
This is 15 to 20 languages.
In New Amsterdam itself, famously, there were 18 languages being spoken when there were only about 500 people living there. And so New York was New York even before it was New York. But Ross Perlin wrote a book last year called Language City about New York, in which he argues that New York is the most linguistically diverse place in the history of the world. And he starts with New Amsterdam, and he says, okay, those 18 languages, when they identified that, they were just talking about the European languages. That's what they cared about. But if you add that there were at least three African languages spoken and all the native languages, you're talking 25 or more.
What was it about? I mean, it was ultimately the success that brought the second taking to be where England says, oh, okay, we want some of that.
Yeah, the story of the of England, you know, coming to focus on this ripened fruit, it's a complicated one, but basically from the, and this is really, the island at the center of the world was really a Dutch story. This is probably 60 or 70% an English story, because, I mean, I recapitulate the Dutch story as well, but England in the 17th century was a, you know, to use our term, a deeply polarized society. You had the Puritans, who were essentially religious extremists, and then you had in the English Civil War, the other side are typically called the Royalists, which is a bit of a misnomer because, yes, there were people who supported the monarchy, but the Royalists comprised really everybody who didn't want the Puritans to take over and, you know, outlaw dancing and theater and Christmas and all those things. So that royalist side comprised moderates. It comprised people who believed in religious toleration. And that was under the banner of the Stuart monarchy. So it comes to a height in 1649 when the Puritans cut off the king's head. His sons flee into exile. Then in 1660, they come back and they reassert the monarchy. And then when they do that, what they do almost instantly is they want to do what the Dutch are doing, and they want to build an empire. So they look across the Atlantic, and they see what they see is first New England, English, and further south the settlements in Maryland and Delaware, or Maryland and Virginia. And in between, this Dutch colony. So what they see there are two problems. One is the Dutch colony is Dutch, and they want it to be English. And the second is New England, because New England was founded by the Puritans. And the Puritans were the people who had cut off their father's head. You know, and there was still deep animosity, especially among the Puritans in New England, toward the Stuarts and toward that regime. Ultimately, then, they pick Richard Nichols, and I spend a good amount of time in the book going into his background and how he had known them. He grew up with them. They were little kids together. And when they went into exile, he went with them. He fought with them. And so now they're back on the throne. They have this very complicated two-part mission to organize all of this, you know, very complicated situation in America. They point to this man they've known all their life, and they feel he can deal with it. And not just that, but it's, you know, obviously, you're going to, once you get there on the ground, things are going to be different. And you have to be able to think. I mean, you can't phone home and say, all right, the plan has changed, I'm going to do it this way. And that's what happened. He changed the plan entirely, and that's what the book is about. And he had to be given the latitude to do that.
The makeup of New Amsterdam is fascinating. As you said, it's multifaceted, certainly, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah, the Dutch were the Dutch brought two things. They brought tolerance and they brought capitalism. Long before the word capitalism came into being, they invented at this time the concept of a corporation and shares of stock, and tolerance or religious toleration was officially part of their government. But you have to qualify that. It obviously did not apply to the Africans they enslaved. It didn't apply, I mean, Native Americans were put in a different category altogether. If it applied to Jews, it was in a very limited way. It really applied to other white European Christians. And yet, it was something. It was, you know, because intolerance was official policy in Europe. People thought, and it was common sense, people thought that if you were, I mean, it's a very dangerous world, and if you're going to get ahead, we all have to be on the same page. So we have to have a state religion. Religion is very divisive. The idea that you could build a successful society by welcoming people who speak different languages and worship different faiths was ridiculous. And people didn't, that's what I mean by in saying that people just didn't get it. They found, they couldn't figure out how the Dutch were succeeding so well.
You write early in the book, it's an alluring notion for a writer of history to reach for, in making a point about historic injustice, that descendants of the people who lost Manhattan, the people on the short end of what was arguably history's greatest and most iconic swindle, live on precariously four centuries later, almost literally within the shadows of the skyscrapers. In truth, nobody knows what indigenous tribes participated in that event, let alone which, if any, of the present-day Lenape groups connect back to it. The U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs doesn't even recognize the Ramapo as a tribe, though the state of New Jersey does. The lack of federal recognition has something to do with their tangled lineage, but also with a high-powered smear campaign that Donald Trump waged in the 1990s to protest his Atlantic City casinos from what he feared would be the future of tribal competition. I said it was a book that it took me away, but he on page four, he got in there.
Well, and I wrote that quite a while ago, too. So, yeah, that was a big deal in the 90s. The Ramapo are, I opened the book talking about the Ramapo who were really right across the river in New Jersey. As I was saying, there are many different branches and tribes of the Lenape today. And these are the closest to what was, you know, their homeland of Manhattan. And so I spent a little time with them, in particular with Chief Vincent Mann and his wife, and they regaled me with, and you know, there's lots and lots of newspaper articles, sure, about this when they were applying for federal recognition, and that was one thing that put a stop to it.
When we come to the founding, and as I mentioned in the introduction of this being an invention, how did you start to see it as that?
It's, first of all, it's, you know, when I wrote The Island at the Center of the World 20 years ago, and most people who write about this history, and I think most of us, if to the extent that people think about that, everybody knows New York was once Dutch, and then it became New York. But we have a tendency to think about main events in the past as though they are inevitable. You know, of course, the Americans were going to win the revolution, but they might not have. And so when I stopped and thought about this moment and tried to see it from the perspective of the people on the ground so that it did not seem inevitable because you don't know what's coming tomorrow, then it kind of unfolds, it unwraps the complexity of what they were doing. And you know, I rely on a lot of colleagues. Dennis Mica, my colleague at the New Netherland Institute, has spent a lot of time exploring this and is working on a book on it. It's a complicated thing that they worked out. You know, the English came in, and Richard Nichols was he has four ships, 450 soldiers, which was substantial for the time, packed to the gills with weapons and gunpowder. So he comes, you know, and he's a seasoned, hardened soldier. He comes to do battle. But even before he left, when he was in London, he did his homework. He interviewed people who had lived in the Dutch colony. He interviewed people who had worked in Stuyvesant's government. And he was getting this sense of this place. And then when he's in the harbor, He doesn't sail right up to Manhattan, and he certainly doesn't sail up and start, you know, blowing the place up. He anchors at Gravesend Bay because that was a little English settlement within the Dutch colony. And he starts sending messengers in boats, and then Stuyvesant sends messengers back. And for 2 weeks, they go back and forth, and they're feeling each other out. And from Nichols' perspective, he gets that this is a vibrant place. He doesn't just want the real estate. He wants this secret sauce, whatever it is. And the only way to get it is to keep and to placate all the people in the colony, all these traders. So he, for his side, hatches this idea that what if I offer them everything? Just keep everything you want. You can have your way of life, your homes, your businesses. By all means, keep your trade networks with other parts of the world. And Stuyvesant and the Dutch, for their side, they have been trying for years to get the home country, the West India Company and the Dutch government, to support them. They say, we've got this vibrant colony and we have this big colony, this continent we can exploit. And they got nothing. They got no support. So they knew they were on their own. So that kind of sets up the terms for ultimately a negotiation, a compromise. How can we work something out that will, I mean, it certainly didn't please the Dutch in the home country when they found out about it. But all the people on the ground, this mixed community, people up through this area all the way to Beverwijk, which became Albany, all of those people got something out of it. And obviously the English got something out of it.
Russell Shorto's new book is Taking Manhattan, The Extraordinary Events That Created New York and Shaped America. It's published by Norton. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Special thanks to the Morton Memorial Library in Rhinecliff, New York, and Oblong Books, oblongbooks.com. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on National Productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Russell Shorto, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Bookmark is for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.